From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the president spoke to the country from a devastated New Orleans on September 15th, he vowed to stand behind the victims in their time of need and to help the region's and the nation's poorest citizens. Bold action, in his words, on poverty. Now, just a month later, the president's real action on poverty has spurred a furious debate. Republicans are using the Katrina moment to push for deep cuts in programs for the poor and, they say, for a new way to fight poverty. Critics call it a shameless war on the poor. This hour on Point, politics and American poverty after Hurricane Katrina. You can join the conversation. What should the role of government be in addressing American poverty? Promoting tax cuts to spur economic growth? Investing in the safety net for those in need? Is the country rising to the challenge of poverty put front and center by Katrina? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Jason DeParle, senior writer for the New York Times. He's covered the debate on poverty and policy for the Times. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You began writing about this last week. Tell us about this arc of expectations from that moment. We all remember it, September 15th, the president standing in the French Quarter with the illuminated cathedral behind him and the quite forthright words on poverty. What were the hopes and expectations raised by that moment, and what has happened to them?
Well, the president invoked the language of the civil rights movement, saying that we would overcome the legacy of both economic and racial injustice as we rebuilt New Orleans. So far, the administration has not put forward an anti-poverty plan of its own, and the high spending in the initial weeks after Katrina has provoked a backlash among congressional Republicans who now want to look for offsetting cuts, and that has left traditional poverty programs like food stamps and Medicaid exposed to budget vulnerabilities and likely cuts coming in the next few weeks.
So you've got Congress, Representative Mike Pence and others looking for places to make offsets for the spending on Katrina, and you're saying no small portion of those offsets now appears likely to fall on programs for the poor. Take us through those.
Yeah, well, the in the spring, the Congress passed a budget resolution that called for a $35 billion reduction in domestic spending, and it was widely understood that about $600 million of that would come in food stamps and $10 billion from the Medicaid program. Since the spending of Katrina and the concerns about spending provoked a backlash among the conservative wing of the Republican Party, those targets have been upped from $35 billion to $50 billion, and that leaves food stamps and Medicaid correspondingly likely to take deeper cuts, up from the $10 billion and the $600 million.
Food stamps, Medicaid's block grants that help the poor as well would be included in these cuts?
Well, they're looking at a whole range of domestic programs. So, sure, anything from low-income energy assistance to the welfare payments, a whole community development block grants, any Pell grants, education loans, all sorts of things are potentially at risk.
Jason, is the Republican majority that's pushing for these cuts describing it? Do they see this as a contradiction to be pushing for cuts in poverty programs at a time when poverty's been on such display, or as a deliberate policy, a deliberate even philosophy of pursuing a new attack on poverty?
Tom, in the past you heard talk of cuts for cuts' sake. In other words, we're cutting because these programs damage the poor. We want to reduce welfare dependency. We want to reduce food stamp dependency. You've heard that in the past. For instance, 10 years ago when the welfare program was overhauled, that was a consistent line of argument. You don't hear that in the forefront right now. You hear the stated rationale being, hey, we've got to get spending under control, with the secondary rationale being these programs don't work that much anyways. That's receded a little bit. It's still there. It's still present. But I'd say the real driving factor right now is fear of growing deficits. Now, I have to add, however,
yes,
that fear of growing deficits doesn't lead into a corresponding desire to revisit anything on the tax side. Even as Congress is looking for these spending cuts, it's also looking to enact $70 billion in new tax cuts this year. So on balance, they're going to be if they cut 50 from spending and 70 on the revenue side, they're going to be increasing the deficit by $20 billion.
Still be in the hole, and of course,
still be in the hole, right?
The way tax cuts work, most of those tax cuts go to people who pay the most taxes, which are who are more affluent.
That's absolutely correct, and you will hear a rationale when I've asked about that. Well, hey, is this fair to be cutting poverty programs at the same time you're giving a further tax relief to the very, very affluent? The rationale will be that we have to have economic growth. These tax cuts will promote economic growth. Congressman Pence, who you mentioned before, a leader of the Congressional Conservatives, said a poor man never – he once talked to a welder, a poor man, and never offered him a job. You know, rich men is going to be creating – rich people create jobs. They spur the economy. So this will eventually benefit everyone. That's the line of argument you would hear there.
Jason, you've been covering poverty for a long time. The whole world was shocked by the images out of Katrina. Perhaps we shouldn't have been. We had magazines around the world saying, you know, shame on them. Do you see, and there was this sense, fleeting as it may be in our, you know, rapid media era, sense that the country was going to pull up its socks and do something about poverty.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how short our media cycles are? It seems kind of long ago already, doesn't it?
It does, but of course, we thought it wasn't just a media cycle. We thought it was a national determination. Do you see any evidence, as a reporter, of a gathering effort to turn and more seriously address poverty in this country again, post-Katrina?
No, I don't. I have to say I was surprised at the extent to which poverty got discussed in the first place. Maybe, as you say, I live inside a poverty policy world. It's what I write about and think about a lot. So certainly the subject wasn't new to me. I was surprised that everyone else seemed so surprised to discover there was poverty in the country. But, I was momentarily encouraged by how deeply people seemed to be disturbed by those images. But it certainly seems to have sunk back beneath the waves, and the fiscal situation is such that the long-term deficits are such that we're really hamstrung, and the desire for the preservation or even deepening of tax cuts, I think, just leaves very little that Congress can do budgetarily as long as it adheres to those tax cuts.
The images pass, the deficit sits there, and so does a governing philosophy. Jason DePaul with the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jason DePaul, senior writer for the New York Times. He's author of American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and A Nation's Drive to End Welfare. We're going to be hearing lots of views on what's going on with poverty since Katrina and where we're headed on this subject right now. Joined from Washington by Robert Greenstein, director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Robert Greenstein, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, we are joined by Robert Rector, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Robert Rector, our thanks to you.
Thank you.
Robert Greenstein, to you first. You've been fighting on the poverty front for a long time. Perhaps your hopes were raised in the national attention that came to it after Katrina. What do you see happening in the weeks since?
It's really been a pendulum swing because you could start by saying if there's a poverty problem, you shouldn't start by making it worse. And what's going on Capitol Hill now is discussion of making it worse by a series of cuts in some of the more successful programs that have really made a big impact here. We have the food stamp program, for which there's ample evidence that it has played a large role in largely eliminating the very severe hunger that we did have in the country in the late 60s. And at a minimum, it looks like there will be food stamp changes that will throw 300,000 people, mostly low-income working families with kids, over the side. That's what the president proposed. Mm. But the House of Representatives looks like, in its zeal to preserve tax cuts and cut social programs more, that it could go substantially deeper. In the area of the Medicaid program, again, the Senate may be more moderate here and may focus more on getting savings by going after pharmaceutical companies and managed care companies that are extracting excessive fees. But the House looks like it's going to place particular emphasis on asking very poor people to pay more in premiums and copayments for Medicaid, despite a whole body of evidence that when you do that, a number of people can't come up with the cash and forego needed medical care and get sicker. Another interesting one to watch is going to be the low-income energy assistance program. We're facing 40 to 50% higher heating costs this winter for many of the poor, including poor elderly people, there are going to be real problems between paying the rent, paying heating bills, and putting enough food on the table. We need a temporary increase. It doesn't have to be for every year, but for this winter, we need a temporary increase in funding for that program. It could be cut again as a result of the across-the-board cuts that some of the deficit cutters are talking about.
And a real hardship there in a time of high energy prices. We've got a break coming up, but Robert Rector, I want to get to you first. Do you see a cut in aid to the poor at the same time we've been talking about poverty post-Katrina? Do you read this in the same way?
No. I think, first of all, we have to recognize as a nation that we're spending more this year and last year on assistance to low-income people than we've ever spent. As a nation, we spend about $450 billion a year on aid, food, cash, energy assistance, medical aid, and so forth. Over the next 5 years, we're scheduled to spend about $2.5 trillion on the poor. And whether we cut that 1% or we let it grow 3 or 4%, it's going to go up, even with the Republican proposals. And the real question is, we ought to ask, what are we getting for that expenditure? Do these programs really benefit the poor? And I would say they do not, because they are simply addressing symptoms of poverty. They don't get it why people are poor. In particular, they don't get it why children are poor.
We're going to come back and look at that, if we may, Robert Rector. We've got to take a short break here. Robert Greenstein, Robert Rector in Washington, please stand by. We're talking this hour about politics and poverty and the post-Katrina conservative agenda and the poor. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you see going on here? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about politics and poverty post-Katrina. President Bush stood in New Orleans on September 15th, just a couple of weeks after the hurricane hit town, and spoke very specifically, very directly about the poverty that the world had seen in all the images, so many images, coming out of the Gulf Coast region.
As all of us saw on television, there's also some deep, persistent poverty in this region as well. That poverty has roots in a history of racial discrimination, which cut off generations from the opportunity of America. We have a duty to confront this poverty with bold action. So let us restore all that we have cherished from yesterday, and let us rise above the legacy of inequality.
President Bush in New Orleans on September 15th, that is just a month and a couple of days ago. We're talking about the politics that have emerged since then and where the country is, in fact, headed on poverty. You can join the conversation. When you heard the president speak about bold action in New Orleans, did you believe it would happen? Are we doing a better job now of helping the country's poor than before Hurricane Katrina? And what do you hear in the liberal and conservative framing of the debate on poverty? Can you imagine a bipartisan agenda emerging? Can you imagine a better way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined from Washington by Robert Greenstein, Director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and by Robert Rector, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Mr. Rector, let me ask you about the president's promise of bold action. We have a duty to confront this poverty with bold action. What is the bold action that you see emerging in the weeks since Hurricane Katrina?
Well, we haven't seen or heard very much about it, but I do think that the president has in the past suggested the most bold initiative to fight poverty that I've seen in 40 years. For several years, the president has proposed a new policy to experiment with the root cause of child poverty, which is the collapse of the family in the United States. This is an issue which largely has been taboo to talk about since the Moynihan Report in the early 60s. But in the past, President Bush has stepped up to that and said, look, we have to recognize that a child that's raised without a married father in the home is 8 times more likely to be poor than one who's raised with a father in the home. That almost 2/3 of the child poverty in the United States occurs in single-parent families. And therefore, he has proposed for, I think, 4 years running, a small experimental program to begin to address this core issue of poverty.
How would that be addressed, and how would that be made into bold action rather than small and experimental?
To do something, you know, doing something different than we've done in the last 40 years. I have low standards because we keep repeating the same mistakes. Mm. I think doing something, proposing to do something different, is extremely bold. And really, I think what the president is proposing has been best described by the columnist William Raspberry, that the first and foremost thing we ought to do is go to young adults who are at risk of having children out of wedlock and just talk to them before that occurs about the negative effects. That seems like a very simple thing, but people would be surprised that nowhere in the nation do we do that.
Does cutting food stamps and Medicaid, in your view, encourage people to take their family structure more seriously by creating necessity or hunger?
I would not suggest that, but what I would suggest is that we have spent over $10 trillion on the war on poverty. We are going to spend over the next 5 years, no matter what's cut or what is added, over $2.5 trillion more. And before we dump all of that additional money in there, we ought to ask whether these programs are working. And they really aren't. And I think we need to do something to change them. We need to do something to change the programs so that they really address the two main causes of child poverty in the United States, which are the collapse of marriage and the lack of work among poor parents. If we do that, then we are likely to make progress. If we simply throw money into the same old system, we will come back 20 years from now, New Orleans will be flooded again, and the media will suddenly discover, gee, we have all these poor people. They've been there all along because we didn't have the right policies in place.
Let me turn to Robert Greenstein. Robert, you hear the fundamental Republican critique here. How do you respond to it?
Where does one begin? Robert's figures on how much we're spending on poverty, I think, are too high. It depends on what you count as a poverty program.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just take one issue. The single largest, most expensive program by far is the Medicaid program. It's very expensive. It provides health care to 40 to 50 million low-income people, children, parents, elderly, and disabled people. Now, that money doesn't go into their pocket. The program costs a lot because health care costs a lot in the United States. The leading studies by places like the Urban Institute have found that Medicaid spends less per beneficiary than private health insurance does, that Medicaid costs are rising more slowly in recent years than private health insurance costs are, but they're still rising substantially because health care costs throughout the whole country are going up a lot. That's why even if you cut these programs, the absolute dollar amounts go up. Well, let's take a specific example. The state of Missouri this year cut the income limit for poor, working poor parents to qualify for health insurance through Medicaid from about 3/4 of the poverty line to 22% of the poverty line. You make like $8,000 a year, you can't get Medicaid anymore as a parent in the state of Missouri. Because doctors and hospitals and labs charge more each year for Medicaid, just like they do for all the private insurance most of us have, the total dollars that Missouri will spend will probably go up. That doesn't mean there hasn't been a cut there.
But where's the Republican answer to this? People are just without health care in greater numbers than ever. The poverty level has risen during George Bush's time in office after having fallen 7% in years under Bill Clinton. Where's the Republican answer? Where's the bold action? I'm still listening.
Well, there is no bold action. Let's take marriage. I mean, I'm all for the experiment that Robert talked about that President Bush proposed, but the amount of money is very small. It's a very small experiment. Meanwhile, at the same time that Bush is talking about that experiment, in 2003, when he proposed to speed up the implementation of the tax cuts for high-income people, and he speeded up marriage penalty relief for middle-income and high-income people, he left out speeding up the marriage penalty relief for the working poor. We have something called an earned income tax credit.
Right.
Both Robert and I have supported it over the years. It encourages work, but it has a marriage penalty. I think Robert and I both agree that that penalty needs to be reduced. What did the Bush administration do? Well, this is a tax cut for lower-income people. That can wait till 2008. But the more fundamental point is the one Robert raised about whether these programs fail or succeed. Now, of course, not every program succeeds. Some of the ones that were less effective, like the old welfare program, have been radically overhauled back in the 90s. But if you look at the ones that we have today, if you take the census data, what they tell you is that the current programs reduce the number of poor people by about 27 million. They bring the average income of the poor, and this is counting things like food stamps and the earned income credit as income, from a quarter of the poverty line to over half of the poverty line. They provide health care to 50 million people, and there is a whole body of research that shows that Medicaid has significantly reduced infant mortality.
These sound like incredibly real impacts.
Black children. They are very substantial impacts. Millions of poor people with disabilities can live in the community rather than having to be warehoused in institutions.
So when these programs are cut, does this then not amount to the war on the poor that critics of this policy are planning on? Or to put it another way, the president's words in New Orleans are being assailed as just kind of Karl Rovian language. He didn't really mean it. I heard you say, no, there's not bold action. The country's waiting. The country woke up in that moment and said, what can we do? Are you saying it's not really there? It's not happening.
It's the reverse of that. We're talking about cutting programs in the name of paying for expenses on the hurricane. And at the same time, the people that want to cut the programs on Capitol Hill not only rule off limits, revisiting any of the tax cuts, which now average over $100,000 a year for people that make over $1 million a year, but in addition to that, there are two new tax cuts exclusively for high-income people. Over half of them will go to people that make over $1 million a year. It'll be another $19,000 a year tax cut for people that make over $1 million a year, according to the Brookings Institution and the Urban Institute. They are slated to take effect January 1st. They're not in effect yet.
But they're coming, Mr. Rector. You're our conservative guest from the Heritage Foundation, and you, too, are saying this is wrong? Have I got you correct?
No, I'm saying that whatever Mr. Greenstein is saying and whatever whether these cuts, so-called cuts, are enacted or not, we will still end up spending more money, okay? And we could come back in 4 years and we would have record new spending levels on these programs. The problem is that particularly when you're talking about aiding able-bodied adults with children, that these programs essentially are serving as a substitute for work and marriage. And as a result of that, when you put money into them, you get less work and you have very little impact on poverty. What we've actually done in the last 3 years is take substantial steps backwards from the welfare reform that was enacted in the mid-1990s, where we required able-bodied parents to either prepare for work or do community services in exchange for aid. When we did that, the welfare rolls dropped, the spending on cash welfare checks dropped, employment went up, and poverty dropped very radically. Now, in the last couple of years,
of course, there was economic growth and more jobs.
It certainly was
an unprecedented drop in child poverty, particularly among single parents, that had far transcended any previous period of economic boom, okay? And the reality is, though, that those work requirements have now lapsed. In public housing, in food stamps, for the most part in the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, people now get cash without being required to take any positive steps to improve their own lives. That's a big mistake, and when you do that, you're not going to have much impact on poverty. You're not going to have much good impact on the well-being of children.
I want to bring some more voices into this conversation, if I may. We've got a lot of callers waiting to join us and others. Sheila's calling from DePoyster, New York. Hi, Sheila. What do you see?
I see a big problem because, I'm a Republican.
Okay.
I'm married. Mm-hmm. I have two kids, my husband and I, hard workers, but it wouldn't take much to send us over the edge. I would say we're not working poor, but we could get there very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, where is this family value thing? How can you justify it when people like me, not a single mother, I've got a college education, both of us do, and we're on the edge.
You're saying don't lecture me on family values. I am the married with kids and working hard person, and I feel vulnerable.
Oh, I'm very vulnerable, and so are the working couples that I know. And we're not out spending on new cars and new houses. we're out spending to survive.
And we hear your fear. Sheila, thank you very much for that call. There's a kind of one angle of reality check there. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, if I may. From Washington, Robert Woodson joins us. He's president of the National Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, a conservative policy group. Mr. Woodson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You just heard there a voice of a caller upstate New York saying, look, I've done all the right things. I'm married. I'm sticking by my kids. We're working hard. Don't lecture me on family values. I feel vulnerable. Where's the bold action to keep her from feeling that vulnerability, to bring those already in poverty out?
Well, first of all, let me correct your introduction of me. We are not a conservative policy organization. We are a community action organization that I founded 23 years ago.
All right.
And we have low-income constituents in 29 states and over 2,000. And so that we are in the trenches providing assistance to low-income leaders and trying to reflect their voices.
Has Katrina awakened the country to the kind of problems you've been dealing with? Do you see a bold new effort to address poverty in this country?
I haven't seen it, but I think, as Robert Rector said, certainly what we are doing has not worked. And I'm tired of this kind of bipolar debate between the left and the right that says that the left looks at poor people and see a sea of victims to be rescued by professional service industry that we've spent trillions on in the last 40 years, and poverty continues to expand.
How do we get out of that bipolar debate?
Well, for one thing, as they said when they issued the report on the 9/11, there is a dearth of imagination. And so I think that first of all, I haven't heard in any of this discussion this morning the words self-sufficiency, independence, and empowerment for poor people. We talk about them as if they are aliens to be rescued from themselves. So I really think we need to talk about brand new policies that look at the poor as an important part of the workforce.
The president himself spoke in New Orleans of, quote, a history of racial discrimination and, quote, people cut off generations from the opportunity of America. Those
well,
do seem like...
Well, I think the president was wrong. We need to disconnect race from poverty, and that's the problem. Because right here in Washington, D.C., we lead the nation in 21 separate categories of poverty expenditures, and we have people of color running all institutions, and five of our major poverty, child welfare, housing, are in court-ordered receivership. 55 of these organizations, child welfare institutions, are in court-ordered receivership. So
you're saying bootstraps is your answer. How do we get people to where they can do that effectively?
First of all, you got to disaggregate this population. And you got to begin to do things like the president has proposed. Why not make the poor owners of property, like the American Dream Down Payment Act that gives $5,000 to first-time home buyers? We have 100 workshops a year teaching the poor how to be better stewards of money.
Has that program been implemented? Are they getting $5,000 to help buy?
Yes, they are. And more blacks and low-income blacks are becoming homeowners than ever before. So, and I think we need to expand the amount of time it takes to pay a mortgage. We should give 50-year mortgages, which will lower the amount of money that a lower-income person needs to make payments. But we ought to promote ownership. I think education vouchers and voucherize a lot of these programs so the poor can become consumers that would require the social service providers to compete for their business.
More autonomy for those poor.
Absolutely, but I don't hear the word autonomy, self-sufficiency, empowerment.
And you're looking for it. If you'll excuse me, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Robert Woodson, we've just got you for a few seconds longer. Do you hear Republicans using those words any more than Democrats?
Yes, I do. And the very fact that the American Dream Down Payment Act came from this administration, the faith-based organizations that have a dramatic examples of reducing alcohol and drug addiction among this same population, they are ignored and have been ignored as a resource. Instead, the existing poverty system favors secular therapeutic-based programs to help alcohol abusers.
Well cuts are coming. We'll see what replaces that. Robert Woodson at the National Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, thank you very much for being with us. Listeners, we're talking this hour about politics and poverty post-Katrina. You can join us 1-800-423-8255. Robert Rector, Robert Greenstein, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about politics and poverty post-Hurricane Katrina. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined in this hour by Robert Rector from the Heritage Foundation, Robert Greenstein from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and right now from New York by Jane Nitzer, Executive Director of the National Center for Children in Poverty at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Jane Nitzer, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
So you've said let's get beyond left and right in this conversation, in this debate. We just heard Robert Woodson say the same thing. Bootstraps, he said, and let's not be stuck. How do we get beyond this? How do we muster effective, bold action in the wake of the kind of wake-up call there, Jane?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is really take a look at what the challenge is. And I think Sheila set the stage very well. The problem of poverty and low-income families is about working hard and not surviving, or barely surviving. You know, all Americans have a shared goal. Let's just take this as a given. We want to raise children to thrive. That means having enough resources to pay for child care or to have access to child care, health care, etc. The reality is that it takes twice the poverty level to get there. The poverty level is $19,000. Imagine trying to fill up your car so you could get to a job. Imagine trying to fill up a backpack.
And that's for a family of four. 7.8% of whites under that, 24.7% of blacks, 21.9% among Hispanics, 19.2% for a family of four.
Correct, 19.2%. And we know that for a family to provide basic necessities for their kids, it takes twice that.
So do you see the accusation here is that post-Katrina, instead of bold action, there's a war on the poor? Republicans say, no, we're clearing out this old these programs that have created dependency. Let's not be so stuck on them. What's the middle? Is there a middle path or a best path here, Jane?
Well, I think there is a middle path. I think we need to protect what's working. And I think Bob Greenstein talked very eloquently about, you know, some of the benefits for Medicaid, for children's health. Certainly Medicaid has been, we really are covering children. The program isn't perfect, but it works. We don't cover families. But the other reality is that we haven't even talked about some of the other strategies that are working. The Earned Income Tax Credit, which lifts about 2.5 million children out of poverty every year. So we need to protect and preserve and strengthen what's working. And I think it's also right that we need to explore incentives for home ownership. The truth is that we have about 7% of families in dire poverty, which is some of the families we saw on the visual crash course in poverty.
Yep.
From New Orleans.
New Orleans. Mm.
And they are earning 50% of the poverty level or less.
So when we keep the tax cuts, which go to the more affluent, and make these cuts that appear to be coming in food stamps, in Medicaid, how do you interpret that? Does that indicate a commitment to find an optimum path here, or is that just kind of cutting people loose?
At the moment, it seems more like the latter. But I think the other point that I really want to make is that, you know, people have talked about the need to incentivize families to work. 83% of low-income families have somebody working full-time. And there's another group that Sheila was talking about who are, you know, one a job loss or divorce or crisis away. This is we're talking about a large group of American families. We have about 29 million children who are growing up in low-income families, whose families are facing dire hardship every day. That is a significant problem, and to talk about single silver bullet solutions at this point simply doesn't make sense.
We get it. We're looking to fix it, and you help us on compass settings that are pretty tough here. But Jane Nitzer, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Pleasure.
Let me turn to our callers. Ron is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very passionate about this. The Democratic policies, and I'm neither a Democrat or a Republican.
Okay.
The problem in the poor community, whether it be because it's not a race issue, the problem's only being perpetuated by the policies as they are. I'll give you an example. When I go into groceries, I'm a working class citizen. I drive a truck.
Yes, sir.
I go to school at night.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go in the grocery store on the first of the month, or the middle of the month, and I see people buying ribeye steaks, crab legs, with a green card, okay? I don't have a problem with helping people, but you have a whole class of people that have become comfortable not working and getting this. I've heard people.
You're talking about people with food stamps at the supermarket?
People, I'm not talking about Katrina. Anyone can be faced with calamity at any time in their life.
Yep.
I'm not talking about that temporary situation. I'm talking about career recipients of these programs.
And comfortable as a way of life. Ron, stick with us. Robert Greenstein, what do you say to Ron's complaint?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what he's saying. A green card is a legal immigrant who's authorized to work. Some of those people may make significant salaries and be able to afford that. Contrary to what Robert Rector said, there are work requirements in programs like food stamps, and the percentage of the program that consists of people who work is significantly higher now, not counting the elderly people, than the percentage of people who don't.
So are you saying there's no longer a problem in this country with people acclimated to dependence on welfare? We got out of that in the 90s. That's behind us?
No, I'm not saying there's no problem at all. But as Jane Nitzer said,
mm-hmm.
the majority of people who are low income are people who work. There have been these stories sort of for years of, oh, these people get food stamps and they buy steak and lobster.
Right.
There have been many studies of it, and the studies consistently find that while there may be a person here or there that does that, I don't deny that there are some, but the studies very consistently show that low-income people buy much less expensive foods than higher-income people do. And, you know, one thing that hasn't been mentioned here, if I might bring it up, is the question of the minimum wage. You know, one of the reasons that people were as poor as they were in New Orleans is that's a low-wage area. A larger proportion of people there are minimum wage. We have gone 8 years without adjusting the minimum wage. It's fallen significantly in purchasing power. It's not at the level it was in the late 1990s, when things are better. We've basically been following a policy here of large tax cuts for people at the top, budget cuts, and frozen wages for people at the bottom, and it has an effect. And one of the reasons, by the way, also that the poverty was so deep, what we saw on our TV screens in New Orleans, is that the assistance programs are much weaker down there. They go in the direction that Robert Rector would like. They give you less to live on. We had more people on the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment insurance, average unemployment insurance payments in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama are the lowest in the country. They're only half of the poverty line.
And these are some of the poorest states in the country.
Cash assistance payments average about, for people on welfare, average about 20% of the poverty line. And here's a telling statistic. The 10 states with the most generous assistance programs for the poor have a poverty rate that is half that of the 10 states with the most parsimonious systems, which are like the ones in the Deep South. Now, I'm not saying the answer is simply to expand every one of those programs. We have to very carefully look and find the things that work. And here's maybe one suggestion that might get agreement across the political spectrum. An idea that was originally a conservative idea, a very good idea in the 1970s under President Nixon, was stop building public housing projects and focus on housing vouchers. The housing voucher lets the family that gets it rent an apartment. You pay 30% of income for rent. The voucher covers the rest. You're limited to modest apartments. You can't get a high-cost apartment. But it enables you to move out of a deeply concentrated area to an area where there are better jobs, better schools, and less crime.
Isn't President Bush pushing in this direction with the $3,000 or $5,000subsidy help on home ownership?
Exactly the reverse. President Bush has put a small money out for a tiny number of low-income people to become homeowners while proposing multi-billion dollar cuts in housing vouchers that in the past conservatives like Jack Kemp championed. We ought to have, in my view, a national consensus across the political spectrum. Bob Woodson talked about vouchers.
Yep.
Let's expand housing vouchers and let's try to structure something that people can more readily get to places where there are more jobs and more schools. None of us would want to raise our own children in areas with deep poverty, high crime, few jobs, and urban blight. The program has been found, particularly for children, children and families that take vouchers and move to areas which have better schools and better jobs. The children have higher high school graduation rates, college graduation rates, employment rates, wage levels,
We get it. It's hard to follow. It's kind of a three-card Monty game here. Everybody professes best intentions, and where the really effective thing lies is hard to keep track of. Ron, we thank you for your call. Gail is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Gail. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good.
Thanks for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. Well, I'm a geriatric social worker. I actually work in a fairly affluent neighborhood outside of Boston.
Okay.
And listening to your guests is making me really, really ticked off.
Tell us why.
Well, because I have people, I work with pretty significantly poor elderly folks who every year are faced with a choice between heating their homes, eating, or paying for their medicines. And all I'm hearing about from George Bush is that they want to give money to the rich and cut services for the poor. Well, I started doing this work probably 25 years ago, and there was always a way to get something for people who needed it. If they needed $100 to buy medical equipment, you could find it. Right now, there's nothing left out there. I mean, I can maybe get a bag of groceries once in a while for someone, but there's nothing left.
And winter's coming, and you're saying you don't want to hear about slackers mooching off the system. These are people who they're old. They don't really have options.
There's nothing left. And I think someone said in this call recently, the president's war on the poor. That's how I am feeling. That's how my elderly folks are feeling when I talk with them. What can I do? What can I give to these people? Because they've worked hard their whole lives and they deserve a little bit better than what they're getting from George Bush right about now.
Gail, we appreciate that view from the field. Robert Rector, what do you say to that perspective?
Well, again, it's pretty hard to see how that can be happening since we're spending record amounts on the poor. I've been doing this for 20 years, and you always have that kind of sky is falling, and we're always talking about...
Gail's just talking about the people she deals directly with, the elders she deals directly with who don't have enough money in this coming winter to heat their homes.
Well, that's what she would say. I really don't see that, and I think if you talk to the broader welfare agency, they wouldn't be saying that either, all right? We can always create a kind of sense of alarm. The reality is to come back to the fundamental issue that... We've said, are there initiatives out here? Do the Republicans have new ideas? And the answer is yes. Republicans have had bold new ideas that may or may not work, but at least they're new and they are bold. For many years, Republicans would like to have the welfare system require able-bodied people to work or prepare for work as a condition for getting aid. I think that would dramatically reduce poverty in the U.S. if, for example, each poor family with children worked full-time, with one adult full-time full year, the poverty rate would drop 70%.
And what about the report we heard that 80-some percent of families in poverty have at least one working person already?
That's the average poor family with children works about 16 hours a week on average. That figure seemed to be very wrong to me.
What about the minimum wage complaint?
Let me go on with what the agenda is. Republicans have also said that we need to voucherize services, we need to voucherize education, we need to bring in faith-based agencies. All of that is basically stymied. And Republicans have also said...
Why is it stymied? Republicans are in the majority. They own Washington.
Well, you have to have 60 votes to get anything out of the Senate, okay? So they don't own the Senate, and most of these proposals have died in the Senate year after year after year. The most important one of which, I would come back to what I started the hour with, which is to recognize that the key cause of child poverty is the disintegration of marriage, one out of three children born out of wedlock. We've had a very modest proposal on that sitting in the Senate now for 4 years, okay, and it's died over and over again. So to say that, yes, in a certain sense, this is a debate between let's just spend more on the old programs, and unfortunately, when I think these new initiatives get thwarted, Republicans tend to fall back and say, okay, let's just cut these programs. You guys aren't willing to do anything new and different.
But stay married, folks, is the main message I'm hearing from you, Robert Rector. In this hour, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Mr. Rector at the Heritage Foundation, we thank you, and Robert Greenstein at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, thank you to you both. In a moment, Jack Beatty brings us a personal take on living in poverty. This is On Point. .7% of Americans live in poverty, according to the most recent census numbers. That's 37 million Americans. As we've heard, it's difficult to pinpoint the exact causes of such high poverty levels, but the consequences are clear and real, and something On Point News analyst Jack Beatty knows a little about from personal experience.
The rich are different from you and me, F. Scott Fitzgerald said for the ages. Less famous is Ernest Hemingway's retort, yes, they have more money. He won that round, I think. Differences in manners and morals among us correlate wonderfully with how much we've got to lose. Papa's realism is lost on the moralists in the commentariat who discovered the poor during Katrina, taking the inverse Fitzgerald line that the qualities of the poor, habits, lifestyle, seal their poverty. They poo-poo trifling things like lack of cash while working for America's biggest and cheapest employer. Their theory fails the test of my experience, and yours, and even theirs, I'll bet. Here's how I lost my good qualities and became a thief. I was 16, had left home, and was wandering the North Woods looking for a job as a lumberjack. Broke and hungry, I ordered a steak dinner at a Bangor hotel, ate every guilt-sweetened crumb, and then tried to run out on the check, and would have made it, too, if the waiter I stiffed hadn't nabbed me at the door and marched me to the kitchen, where I washed dishes until my hands turned corduroy. My habits didn't make me do it. I had the best habits a Catholic home could instill, but hunger and narcissism, I deserve to eat, overrode them. Even Brooke Astor, the aged New York heiress, would steal before she'd starve on principle. We are rarely better than our circumstances. So, yes, the poor are different from you and me. They've got less money, and their worst habit is resignation to injustice.
Jack Beatty is On Point News analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.